So we're live, and our first hiccup here is I had forgotten where to find the Net That Hall that intro.
Oh, so do we a cappella it?
I'm gonna try this. So we're just gonna go without it, I guess. Sorry.
No, it's okay. I was gonna volunteer singing it, but sure.
You want to try to sing it? I wonder if this one's it. Just kidding. Okay, so here we go. Obviously, Mariner's not here to drive the Net That Hall ship today. So. Lucien and I got started without the video intro because I didn't know where it was, and I just got back from the repair shop where I had to take my car. So we're a little bit already like, oh, I know, right? Oh, the irony. So we're a little bit behind the gun already, a minute and a half in, 90 seconds in, and we know we're trying to keep it to under an hour. So I'm going to get right to it. I'm Gabe at FPL Lens on the X app, formerly known as Twitter. You are watching Net That Hall review show for game week 7, obviously minus 1, the double game week fixture. And we're joined, as we are every review show, by Lucien, FPL teacher. What's up, my friend?
Oh, I'm just grateful for the extra conversation time I get to have with you, as well as the audience, hopefully this time, because I don't think we ever interact with our audience. And I'm, you know, just looking forward to take any questions anybody has, because, you know, obviously with 60 minutes split between the two of us, that's probably going to be a little less intro time and more focus on hopefully the process side of things as we look through each of the 10 games, minus the double game week, of course.
Of course. And on that note, we will get right into it as we try to stay on track here, 2.5 minutes in, and just go right into the first fixture. There was some madness. I missed all the games live. I caught up on Sunday. Many of the games I haven't seen in their entirety myself, but I did watch several. So here we go. First, before we get to it, Game Week 7 review. You know, Mariner always likes to put the highest point getters. And this week we have Watkins, 23 points. Odegaard, 17 points. Anderson, 15. Ben White, 14. Colwell, 12. Trippier, 12. Sofal, 12. Almiron. I know everyone likes Miguel Almiron, 10 points. And Dominguez from Forest with 10 points. Not going to really comment on the kind of like outcomes we're seeing here. We're just going to keep moving along. So the first match, and that was Aston Villa hosting Brighton. Net XG 1.72 for Villa, 1.15 for Brighton. The FDR followed it up kind of back with 2.8 for Villa, 1.6 for Brighton. What can you tell us about this matchup?
Well, Gabe, it's painful to say, but as much as we'd like to say that Unai Emery has progressed away from the box, he has basically brought it back. I think there's something special about Emery's unpredictability, volatility. There's just something unpredictable about him that is that actually throws opponents off, at least compared to the way Arsenal and Man United do it at the moment, because you just cannot tell how Villa are going to beat you, because sometimes Villa whip out the 3-5-2 extremely wide formation, and this time round they went narrow. I mean, can you imagine? You take your usual four box midfielders and you lay them out as a diamond. I mean, how long ago have we seen this diamond shape, right? That's extremely refreshing, to say the least. And this narrow structure basically threw Brighton off. I think Brighton themselves, as usual, do Brighton things and shoot themselves in the foot. And I think one of the underrated pairs that we see here is Gross and Dahoud in central midfield, right? The replacement pair for Casado and McAllister, the first choice default pair. We talk about weaknesses all over the pitch, from James Milner to their centre-backs individually. But really, this time round, for the first time in a long while, Brighton actually looked constipated. Not because of Mitoma's positioning, but really because of this lack of penetration through the center. Like you see Shin Sho-woon and you see Gilmore, right? They have the ball in the center of midfield and you see all of these dynamic runs made up front and they just cannot find their runners up front. It's sad to see. And really, it took until midway through the second half where Joel Veltman actually, as the right back, managed to bomb forward and support them. So yeah, I think it's going to be another transition phase for Brighton, especially if they persist with this midfield too. However, I think most encouraging is that Ansu Fati, Brighton fans will have their ears up here, played the number 9 instead of overloading the left side with Mitoma this time. And it had huge implications because Brighton's front two basically swapped themselves around the aisle mark. And what happened was, no one initially supported Mitoma on the left-hand side. Like, you could see in the first half, right, where Mitoma had the ball on the left. And then we know what type of player Evan Ferguson is, right? He's like the prodigy of Harry Kane's, where he sits in line with the back four and he's like, give me the ball, ball to feet, ball to feet. And Mitoma just refuses to pass to him because Villa see it coming. And so instead, with Joao Pedro in the second half, things were just a lot more incisive. You know, Joao Pedro doing his usual left half space byline thing. And that was how they got their consolation goal. I think, really long story short, we just cannot doubt the finishing power of Watkins, how he's doing right now. We just cannot ignore that at the very least, because we're so used to Watkins converting like less than 10% of his chances. And now he's converting way over 10%. We just enjoy it while it lasts. You know, it's kind of like similar to the form of a certain Man United winger. Exactly the same thing. I think we can just end it there.
Yeah, I did want to get something in here, but we do have to move on to the next fixture really quickly. I wrote Villa are a long cry from their narrow 4-2-2-2 in the slide, and apparently not. And you talked about Emery's unpredictability. So another thing that we thought we had seen this season, or we had seen this season, to be fair, was Watkins setting up Diaby. And now we know that it can be the other way as well. So I think it's really just about targeting now that we've seen the narrow 4-2-2-2 come back against a team that likes to play wide. It'll be interesting to see from a matchups perspective moving forward, if we can start to predict or like start to see a pattern to what now seems like Emery's unpredictability. Because if we can, then, you know, for Diaby owners like myself, we can kind of like anticipate their scenarios a little bit better, and you know, Diaby could have gotten a lot more than he did as well. Okay, moving on to the next fixture, Bournemouth hosting Arsenal. Interesting muted data here for both of these sides. Arsenal 1.39 net XG, Bournemouth 0.98. FDR, Arsenal negative 0.2, Bournemouth negative 0.1. Surely a function of home and away. But the shots goal predictor continues to be bullish on Arsenal. What did you see in this one?
Well, I do feel that a very, very big factor, at least compared to most recent games, is the presence of a certain German that has not been able to score a goal, at least until this game. I mean, Kai Havertz took up the left half space yet again. He made fantastic runs, and he was found early on yet again. But still, everything off Arsenal's flows down that right-hand side. And I'm not saying that, you know, buy Bukayo Saka without thinking, because Odegaard's 17-pointer here was worth every single penny. I think we just fail to consider that Odegaard pulls strings in midfield so hard that sometimes, you know, we see him play a facilitator one game, but the idea of owning Arsenal players, especially from game week 10 onwards, means that we should hold them at least for the medium term. This also did not consider the fact that now Jesus is officially playing on the left wing while Nketiah plays the number 9. It's a completely different dynamic here. You know, it's completely different from when Jesus played the number 9 and Granit Xhaka was on the left half space. So now it's purely functional. Everything still flows down the left-hand side. Yes, flows down the right-hand side. Jesus is waiting for the ball on the left. Kai Havertz is somewhere. And Nketiah is the one benefiting from all these big chances. Although, having said that, the slides also mention Solanke benefiting from Declan Rice's absence, which Declan Rice played. So we'll have to chuck that out the window. I think, more importantly, is For Arsenal, there is something special happening down that left-hand side. It's not coming from the midfield. It's not coming from Jesus playing on the left. It's actually coming from Oleksandr Zinchenko, our nominal midfielder playing at left-back, roaming all the way to the right half space in the opposition penalty area. That is what we are looking out for, and that is the key reason why Odegaard is shining so brightly right now. We do not see left-backs go all the way into right midfield until now. So keep a lookout for that. And so long as Zinchenko plays, Odegaard will continue to shine.
What I would add to that is in easier matchups, in easier fixtures. In more difficult fixtures, I don't think Zinchenko will have that kind of freedom to roam around the field and support Odegaard and help him get into the box. So, yeah, right on. Great analysis. I don't disagree with anything. Nothing to add. Rice played. Everybody that was hurt played, except for Bob. Damn it. So our next fixture is, we can go through with this one probably kind of quickly. Everton Luton. Everton at home with a net XG of 1.42. Luton 0.92 net XG. The FDR disagrees, or it's a little more bullish on Everton, and maybe it has something to do with the green shot predictors as well. Everton 3.5 in the FDR compared to Luton negative 2.1. What do you see in this one?
Yeah, I think the scary thing here is that even your zonals predicted that Everton would be more productive down their right side, when in this case it was completely different. Everton versus Luton genuinely felt like a championship level match where you had 10 supporters and you basically revolved around one key duel down Everton's left hand side. From the first minute, literally, ball comes in long, and then I think it was like Kabore who like gets the clearance, but the clearance is weak. McNeil takes it first time on his chest, lets the ball bounce, and he hits it from range, right? The whole crowd, myself included, watching this game, thought it was going into the top corner. It doesn't, but McNeil basically tortured Kabore all game. It was so bad to the point where one of Luton's forwards, the right forward, Jacob Brown, had to actually double back and help his wing back out just among Dwight McNeil as well as Mikulenko throughout the whole game. So that was one of the key duels that Everton absolutely dominated. So unfortunately, your key duel here saying Pickford against Morris had to be flipped, because this was all about it was all about Pickford against Luton's extremely tall centre backs. So one other reason I say that this was a championship level game was because the shenanigans you see Luton do on set pieces and corners and in open play is absolutely something you expect out of the championship, where you had multiple players barricading Everton players just to make sure that you create space for like that one guy. It's all really, what do you call it, as Chris would say, shithousery stuff. And yeah, I'm just glad that Luton got what they deserve, because everything, yeah, just profited from that that hidden matchup. Now, a quick note on Brown and Giles, because Alfie Doty deserves full credit for taking on his position, taking on his role well in place of Ryan Giles. And one key matchup I think we will be talking about quite soon is Doty's outswingers from the left side. Left footer on the left flank, putting in outswingers is going to come up with some really beautiful result, considering the fact that one of Luton's centre-backs looks like it's the skinny version of Hagrid. Rip Hagrid. But yeah, it looks like that at the moment, you know, bring the ball to the tallest guy that isn't Haaland. And that's how Luton won their games.
Yeah, I mean, in the slide, while the zonal lights up for the right-hand side for Everton, in the slide I did mention McNeil on who's been playing on the left. So it's interesting that the zonals didn't work out at all. We saw the opposite in this one. And sometimes it is about personnel. Cool. Next fixture, Manchester United versus Crystal Palace. Interesting. I like this. Crystal Palace, net XG 1.07, Manchester United 1.55. I guess I would say the FDR is in slight disagreement here. Crystal Palace negative 0.6 compared to Manchester United 2.1. lot more bullish on United than NetXG is. What happened here?
when the most dysfunctional attacking side plays against one of the most practical defensive sides in the league, it's basically what's the word, hit tennis, as newspapers would put it. Okay so this really sums it up, right? There is this one particular shot that I noted, right, from that Man United game. Let me see if I can find it. It had an XG of 0.01. Nobody would care about this, but the highlights picked it up, right? 27th minute, right after Anderson took the lead for Crystal Palace. Okay? Because your notes here says long diagonals to Rashford, and it was spot on. Casemiro, right half space, deep midfield, goes long. Phew! Beautiful long ball for Marcus Rashford. He takes it in his stride, first touch. Guess what he does? Take a guess what he does.
It goes under his foot and goes out.
Even worse, he crosses the ball with his left foot. It goes past everybody all the way back outside the penalty area for Casemiro. Return the sender. And Casemiro basically takes an extremely long shot from range. And it looked good. Casemiro looked really, really good this game. And that is the extent to how sputtering Man United are right now. It's not even constipated. It's literal shit. I mean, the good news though is that Ten Hag did adjust things a little bit at halftime, and he decided to play diagonals to Diogo Dalot at right back. So I think in terms of having a punt, Diogo Dalot is going to be something that will probably benefit from Wan-Bissaka's absence in the future. And as for Palace, well, without Eze, I think it was that recent news that he's out for 6 weeks. Everything falls on the two centre-backs. Everything just falls on the two centre-backs. I want to talk about talismans, but I mean, right, I posed the same question to Chris last week. If you only score two goals, what's the point of getting 80% of two goals, right? What's the point?
And two goals, I think, is often generous for a prediction for Palace, given how passive they are as well. So, I got to say, I'm really glad I missed it. I didn't watch this game. 2 hours of my life that I will keep to myself forever and not have given to this disaster. Enough about United. I'm sure we'll bring them up some more in tomorrow's matchup show. But really not much to talk about for United. Here we have Newcastle versus Burnley. Burnley with a net XG away of 0.74. Newcastle 2.14. FDR in basic agreement here with Burnley minus 0.32 and Newcastle with a positive 3.7. Did you watch what did you see in this one? New, and especially, I guess, one question: if you were to define a role for Anthony Gordon, if you were to say, what would that be?
Wow, I never considered that. I mean, the thing about Gordon is that his runs and his involvement is explosive. He's not the kind of guy that would be present in every single phase of play. Because Newcastle right now, right? I mean, they've been fielding this midfield of Bruno Guimarães, Anderson, as well as Longstaff recently. I think it's harsh to call them industrious, because Anderson and Longstaff, to their credit, have been making beautiful runs into the penalty area, working with their wingers, working with their fullbacks. And I think among all of this chaos, right, we have to really list Newcastle's strengths one by one, because it's definitely not player-based. Eddie Howe has somehow come up with a system that even though it loses important games, they just have this knack of beating, like being flat track bullies, you know what I mean? And a lot of this comes down to their really famous counter press, which honestly I look forward to watching against PSG, because this very counter press is the reason why Newcastle can sustain their momentum and have the likes of Anderson and all these random players have multiple shots at goal. The whole reason Miguel Almirón could even come up with his worldie, right, was because Kieran Trippier was the one stepping in, dispossessing a Burnley midfielder. It also came from the fact that Miguel Almiron had multiple tries to do his cut and shoot thing from the right hand side. It's the same thing with Anthony Gordon. He had to attempt multiple dribbles before something finally worked in the second half so that he could win the penalty for ASAP to close out the game. There will be some days where Newcastle score literally everything and win 8-0. And there will be some games where they play the volume game, sorry, they play the numbers game, get enough volume, and eventually something works. So in terms of your notes, everything was correct. Like the left having more space, yes, but it was facilitated by the fact that Newcastle can carry out their three-pronged plan A extremely well, from their counter-press to their wing play to Anderson and Longstaff popping up in random half-space positions just to link everything together. As for Burnley, well, they just struggle to get out of second gear. Biggest factor really is Lyle Foster being unavailable. But just the fact that they have this plan in the second half where they replace literally their entire front three for a completely different front three. So we don't know, like, whether this kind of attacking plan will stick, because none of their six attackers so far has impressed, bar Colioso, who played on the right side, had a few decent cutbacks, but it's all bark and no bite at the moment.
I guess one question I'd ask about Newcastle, you know, Harvey Barnes is out for a few months. Anthony Gordon suspended for the Premier League. Obviously, he'll play in Europe against PSG. How do you see that shaping up? Does Almiron go to the left and Jacob Murphy plays on the right or something like that? And if so, how does that change this team? How does that change what Newcastle is doing, if at all?
Well, Jacob Murphy is a much more direct player, that's for sure. And he's also a more mature player, far, far more mature player. And he's more likely to hold position. It just comes down to how Newcastle want to beat teams, because they can always rely on Kieran Trippier to actually send dangerous balls into the box. You know, there's always that. Although I do feel that the central midfielders do have to step up in transition. I think that's the most crucial thing. Without Gordon, I do believe that, you know, depending on how bad the Joel Linton injury is, Joel Linton could very well fill in at left wing. That's absolutely possible, alongside Anderson and Longstaff in central midfield. Absolutely not a problem at all. Or you could play two forwards and play Isak on the left and Wilson through the center if Wilson's available. Yeah, so they've got choices.
Yeah. All right. Time for a little plug. We are, of course, finalists for the third time running in the Football Content Awards 2023. Every full year we've been in existence, we've made the finals. So, vote for the little old Net That Hall. We're up against some really big competition. I'm sure everyone in the chat has already seen this before. Go to footballcontentawards.com/voting. Best in Fantasy Football podcast and Best in Fantasy Football video. Editorial, I always like to throw my all about FPL friends a little shout. They're good people. So if you want to throw them in for editorial as well, that would be really lovely. Thank you all for voting. I think I see people in the chat. Catherine was here, Ballroom Jam, Black Scream, Com is in the house as well. I know all of you all voted, so tell your friends, send it in your WhatsApp group messages, and help us out as we get to the next fixture we're about to review here, and that is West Ham against Sheffield United. Now, this isn't one that I watched. I did see the highlights, but I felt like the highlights really didn't tell me anything in this game, and maybe you can tell me why I have that feeling. But NetXG, Sheffield United away, 1.14. Interestingly, high, I thought. West Ham at 1.91. FDR in slight agreement, I guess, a little more muted than with West Ham, with Sheffield United 0.7, West Ham at 1.9. Shots predictors are red and white. So I'll just let you get right to this one. I'm interested to hear what you're going to say, especially about if James Ward-Prowse and his positioning in this one.
Where do I even begin? Well, I love this fixture for the most random reasons. You know how every fixture is usually like shortened into six letters, right? And we have those matchups. So this is one of the most interesting matchups where usually West Ham is WHM, but I keep every time I come back to analyze this fixture, right? It says Wushu, Wushu, Wushu. Oh my gosh. It's so beautiful because the Asian games are going on right now, and one of the biggest categories of sport is Wushu. Yeah, with the whole sword twirling and all that. Yeah, it's beautiful. So yes, this game did not resemble Wushu at all. It was basically James Ward-Prowse, right? We talk about headed matchups. You want to guess how many headed chances there were this game?
There were a lot. I know Bowen missed a few.
Six.
I don't know.
Six headed chances. Yeah. So this is exactly what you expect out of JWP. It's just a bit unfortunate that he didn't get any assists. So I think what I would like to add to the repertoire of James Ward-Prowse here is that, you know, like, okay, how about this? Let me pose a question to you, right? Let's say I told you that James Ward-Prowse will create multiple chances for his teammates through these trademark crosses, be it set pieces or something down the byline, right? How do you imagine them to be? What would those crosses look like? Give me as much detail as you can. Like what would a typical JWP chance created from a cross look like?
From a cross on what? Where in the on
any,
the field?
Anywhere, up to you. In any context at all, what would be the most likely JWP trademark chance created?
I mean, either set piece, of course, trademark. So, from where?
Which direction?
From
where?
The right side. From the right side, mm-hmm. outswinger coming into the box.
Yeah.
But the way he does it is the arc of, and the reason why his cross is so good is that it looks like a diagonal ball, and the arc is quite late, and that's what makes it
yes.
so effective, because he's able to get around the defender here. My mic is a defender here, around that defender, and then it drops like a baseball curveball or something like that, drops onto the head. But it's like that narrow diagonal, and then boom.
Yes, exactly. That's called top spin. That top spin
there
basically makes
top
the
spin.
Ball
I don't play tennis.
Curve. Yeah. So he does that from the left side this game. So imagine a corner coming in from the left side, right? And he does that exact same technique, and he finds Jared Bowen. I think that's where Bowen's heightened potential comes from, because now, instead of Bowen having to anchor him all by himself on the right side, Thomas Suchek is doing massively different things down that right side. I think the biggest takeaway here, right, as much as we want to say that Bowen is, you know, linking everything together and getting all the chances and getting all these headed goals, we have to understand that there are two triangle networks of passing, of passes trying starting to form. The first most obvious one happens on the right side, where you have Bowen, Sufal, and Thomas Suchek. Crucially, Thomas Suchek, as Colm already mentioned in the comments, is the one actually making that crucial half space run into the box. But that right side, when they establish that triangle, they only create. I think they did it last game as well, where basically they sit deep on the right-hand side and they just put in all these right-footed crosses, you know, looking for all these left half-space players. But here, everything went down the left, and you would see Antonio, JWP, and Thomas Suchek going down the left-hand side. So, yeah, actually the real gem here, especially if you're on a wild card, would, yeah, be Thomas Suchek, if you dare. Thomas Suchek instead of JWP or Bowen, if you dare.
Hey, Thomas Suchek instead of JWP?
Or Bowen, yeah. I mean, I say this because I can imagine certain wildcards trying to shoehorn in Salah, Son, maybe Saka, maybe Madison, and then there's going to be like a differential fourth midfielder like Diaby, right? So, you know, like if you can't afford Bowen, if you can't afford JWP even, like Suchek's 4.9 million, that basically affords you a front three of Haaland, Salah, Haaland, Alvarez, and Watkins.
That's fair. Okay. Okay. Yeah, and you would compare him with players like Sarr or something like that. But But maybe there is, like, if we see this repeated, because I don't know, I still don't trust that that's how it's going to play out in most games. This was against Sheffield United, where or maybe they rely on more of these late runners into the box. But in other fixtures, that has been JWP. So I would need to see a little bit more of some repetition in this one to go Socek. But yeah, Socek did have a different role in this one, and it did show. And I mean, Bowen could have absolutely had a monster haul here. So I still think there's more bang for your buck, despite the more buck needed to get a player like Bowen. But we will certainly see as we move on to the next fixture here. I don't even know if I'm going to say anything. I think I'm just going to let you go. We're only 30 minutes in. We're well past midpoint. We can go like 10 minutes into this fixture if you want, just as a gift to you to brighten your day. This is Wolves against hosting City. Manchester City with a net XG of 1.85, Wolves 0.76. Obviously, FDR in complete agreement. Manchester City with an FDR of 4.7, Wolves negative 1.9. However, reality does not agree with the stats here, Lucien. So tell us about that.
You know where it all went wrong? It started with that presser when Pep forgot his name.
His name, the Korean guy.
No, the Korean guy. My gosh. We might as well feel like Simu Liu in left wing or something, right?
Wait, and who forgot his name? The Spanish guy.
Pep, just Pep.
Oh, the Spanish guy.
Yeah.
I think we should just call him the Spanish guy for the rest of the season.
Yeah, because he did the same thing. Son scored against City, and it was like, you know, the same thing. Yeah, it's terrible. Maybe Pep is racist. Anyway, what we can say though is, I think people rightly pointed out that when you are missing Rodri, you are missing a lot of things. Kovacic is doing all he can to replicate that Rodri role, right? While he's suspended, but the reality is that we actually saw a lot of City defenders getting much more involved in attack than they should. I'm not talking about the fullbacks per se, because I think the fullbacks did as much as they could as well. Walker was extremely high up. I think it's more of Akanji, right? The left center back having to invert into midfield. In the second half, he actually ventured all the way into Wolves' penalty area. And I think the sequence here, right, especially when you look at Huang's winner, is that I think it was Doku that drew out Semedo, right, confronted him 1v1, and then he set Akanji up for a shot, which Jose Sa saved. So that's technically, you know, okay, right? And immediately Sa threw it past Doku, threw it past Akanji, and then suddenly Semedo's on his bike, galloping into the City half, you know? And from there, it's just a matter of crossing it not once but twice for Huang to get the winner. So it's little moments like those that, not to say throw tactics out the window, but it sort of puts City's prestige into doubt. Because as much as we like to say that Pep controls games, he still has to commit certain players forward and out of position, and he will have to concede space. I mean, I think we've been banging on all season now that Pep's biggest weakness is the space behind the left winger. Newcastle tried it. Almiron nearly had something against it. And yeah, Wolves had a few there. Because you wrote in the notes that Neto would go up against Rico Lewis. But honestly, he just went up against Nathan Ake. And it was the same result. But honestly speaking, once again, Wolves have this tendency to benefit from opponents' weaknesses at the right time. Just the same way we beat Liverpool 3-0 last season, we're benefiting here from the fact that, if you notice, right, before Neto burst past Ake to force the own goal, you want to try and recall who he actually beat in midfield to burst into the second half? Into the City half? Which midfielder did Neto beat to venture into his opponent's half?
Probably... What's that?
Who was marking Neto in that moment?
Well, like I said, I didn't watch this game either. But my guess is that it would have been Maybe Kova.
Phil Foden.
Foden was that far back.
Yeah. So, you know, City had to change things up, and they had to adjust to Wolves' biggest threats here. So that is something that City will continue to try and chop and change. But without Rodri, City are incredibly muted. I think it's only one more game left, right? That Rodri is suspended for. So I think not capping Haaland against Arsenal is actually perfectly reasonable. Yeah. I think we can just keep it exactly there. That's the sweet spot that I'd like to end it on.
But what about, like, what do we do with Neto? I mean, he's 5.4 million, so only 0.5 more than what's his name? Socek, right?
He's 5'6".
Oh, Neto's 5'6", the same as Anthony Gordon.
Yeah, he rose yesterday.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's a bit of a quandary because, I mean, when you are talking about fine margins in that price bracket, you are really talking about fine margins. It's like, you know, the difference between owning a Neto and a Lamptey at the back compared to, say, a Suchek and a secure 4.5 million defender. Yeah, the margins are really, really tight. I mean, I would love to say that Neto is fixture-proof. The problem is, when are you going to play your cheapest midfielder? Because we have to keep in mind that, like a lot of us, right, going, if we were to wildcard this week, it's granted that we're going to go Haaland plus Watkins up front. So it comes down to who your third forward is. If your third forward is like Cameron Archer, then Neto's not even part of the conversation. But if your third forward is somebody like Alvarez, right, who also plays Arsenal, but, you know, he will improve over time, then you are looking to owning Neto or someone within that price range as your fifth midfielder, even though he's unlikely to get game time. Because, frankly speaking, nobody really knows which 4.5 million midfielder we want to have. At least Cameron Archer's decent for Sheffield United, 90 minutes and all that. But yeah, if you were to pick a 4.5 million midfielder that plays 90 minutes, you're looking at either Pape Matar or Chris, yeah, Mariner's favorite pick, Marvelous Nakamba. So,
right. Yeah. I don't know. I think Neto is fixture proof, and he's also unpredictable because he relies so much on that 1v1 ability, and he has to create something for himself, often out of nothing. And the things he creates for others will more likely than not be finished. So it's, I think it's risky on that play. I don't really agree with it and we'll talk more about this tomorrow in the matchup show, but I don't think Ollie Watkins is the obvious second forward. I think it's still Alvarez, and I don't think all the Villa don't play a team that allow a lot of space in behind other. I mean, obviously they play Luton in game week 10 and then Fulham in game week 12, but those are the two real good fixtures for Watkins. Other than that, Wolves away, it's fine. West Ham home, not great. Forest away, not great. So I think people have a little bit of recency bias when it comes to Ollie Watkins. But we'll see. We will see. Anything else on this one, Wolves or City?
I think it's just a bit of a caution on investing in this Villa Wolves game. It's going to be a derby. Mm-hmm. It's a Black Country derby. And we have had some crazy stuff the last time Villa and Wolves met. I mean, you know, saying this as a Wolves fan, I recall celebrating a very, very late Ruben Neves goal in the injury time of second half, despite Villa going 2-0 up after 80 minutes. So, yeah, you know, couch and all that. Yeah.
Right. This is the one. Here we go. Tottenham versus Liverpool. All the metrics saw goals here. Liverpool 1.82, Spurs 1.73, FDR, Liverpool 1.5, Spurs 2.0. So a little bit more muted than NetXG. I'm curious about that, where he's getting that from. Although the matchups there don't look super enticing. All the matchups on the NetXG side did look enticing. And Yeah, I mean the metrics saw goals and the reality saw goals, and then you know, Premier League English refereeing, the worst in the world. They said we're going to go against reality on this one and say no goal. So tell us a little bit more about this fixture.
Today we learn how to draw lines using a ruler. Okay, really feels like a primary school class. I'm going to start with the slides. Sun using the space behind Liverpool. Honestly, Liverpool did decently well, not really conceding too much space behind them. Mm-hmm. It was about conceding space around them. I think what they did not expect, especially after seeing the starting lineup, was that Richarlison would play on the left and Sun would go down the middle. Because Richarlison still did this decent job against Joe Gomez. So, you know, I think whatever it is, whoever plays on that right side, you will torture Liverpool's right side really, really heavily. Same thing about Solomon against Liverpool's weak right side. I think we really should put a lot more emphasis on what happened in the first 25 minutes before Curtis Jones got sent off. Yeah. So this was absolutely fascinating, because if you watch the first 25 minutes alone, you will notice some very, very jarring things that stood out. First and foremost, the half space players were so aggressive, it was not funny. Like, so you imagine this, right? If let's say Spurs centre back would have the ball, you would see multiple Liverpool players basically set a bear trap around that Spurs centre-back. So Gakpo would basically do that arcing run that blocks off the pass to the goalkeeper. Robertson would push all the way up to the left half space. Diaz cuts the wing off. And suddenly you see Mickey van de Ven going like, where the hell are my passing options? It's crazy. And you see that exact same thing when Liverpool's centre-backs have the ball. Udogie, left half space, pushes all the way up to make sure that Liverpool centre-backs don't get time on the ball either. It was a crazy, crazy game, to the point where, like, okay, so here's the secret of Postecoglou's philosophy that makes his teams relatively hard to beat. There is this thing called rest defense, where if you commit too many players forward, you leave a lot of space behind, right? That's one of Liverpool and sometimes Arsenal's weaknesses and City's weaknesses going forward. The thing about Spurs is that when you have your fullbacks run into the half spaces, you actually clog up those holes and you prevent counterattacks by having all these players shove up the half spaces. And so you get to sustain play, and Spurs gets to sustain play a lot better. That's why you hardly see any counter-attacking chances, you know, occur against Spurs in the first place. So Liverpool tried to replicate that, and you would basically see this massive amount of spells of possession when Liverpool had the ball and when Spurs had the ball. You saw there was no like random clearances into touch. Yeah, people genuinely played like their way, all the way until Curtis Jones pushed it a little bit too far and the referees decided to slow the camera down a bit too much and the foul looked worse than expected. So,
oh, come on.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. No. I'm surprised that this isn't even a conversation. This is boring to me. You can't go over the ball into a planted leg. I don't care if you go slow, if you go fast, if you go with a smile on your face.
I meant that the cameras slowed it down too much, you know. I mean, I don't disagree that the tackle was potentially dangerous, right? Because that's what we look at nowadays, right? We don't look at the damage that it causes. We look at like the way, how much control the player has before he goes into the tackle. So
no, but going over the ball into a planted leg is a red every time. It doesn't matter how dangerous it looks or how dangerous it could be. This is it's just textbook. Like, it wasn't even, I'm surprised they even had to check it. You could see it in real time because it really wasn't that fast. You could see it in real time. He, you know, he puts his cleats up, he goes over the ball, the opponent's leg is planted, and he goes into the middle of his shin.
Yeah,
I don't know. I'm surprised it was even a conversation or controversial. That's a red card every single time. And yeah, you feel for the guy, right? But I don't know.
I mean, Jones has to learn. He has to learn these things,
He has
right?
to
That
learn.
you just, yeah, he has to learn. He's young and he has to learn these things from experience that you just don't tackle people that way. Even though, you know, it looks relatively harmless, you just don't tackle people that way. Because if you're on the pitch and somebody points their studs at your shin, right? You are genuinely frightened.
Yeah.
Right? Just
Yeah.
yeah, think about being in that center back
And
position.
it's unnecessary. He could bring his foot down in front of the ball and the opponent still can't go anywhere because the ball is wedged between both feet, and then flick it up with his toe, flick it up over the opponent's foot, or have it hit your shin and then you get the second ball. Anyway, yes, it was a yeah, it was a youthful mistake, and he well deserved that red card. And I agree with you. Those first 20 minutes, it was actually a super interesting game. I was enthralled because it was so intense. And I was surprised. I was surprised at Postecoglou's aggressive counter press like that, because Liverpool can play that long diagonal ball, and Spurs got burned with them early. And Luis Diaz's goal should have counted. And who knows how that changes the game? It's going to be interesting to see how this one ends up. But pressing in that way really made sense for Klopp. I thought that was a tactical kind of like stroke of I don't know, a genius, but certainly stroke of intelligence there, where Postecoglou wants his team to play out from the back. And how do you play out if there are no options? I guess the answer to that is a roaming James Maddison from what I saw, which was fun to see as well. Is a shame about the red cards in this game because it was entertaining, otherwise.
Okay, let's go Forest.
Moving to Forest hosting Brentford. Net XG 1.34 for Brentford, 1.22 for Forest, so quite similar. FDR in slight disagreement here was positive 0.2 for Brentford, negative 1.1 for Forest. Let's see. What did you see in this one? This isn't a game that I really watched, and the highlights again didn't show very much. Maybe because not much went on or what. But I have to say I'm coming into this one somewhat ignorant.
Oh, yeah, when you have a Forest game, you are almost guaranteed very few big chances. Very, very, very few big chances. Especially when you consider that Brentford's attack is still getting used to not having Schärder on the left side. They played Lewis Potter again, but let's focus on Brentford, more on the boys, right? Because Forest had to play defensive against, I don't even remember who they played last week. But yeah, they had to rest both their wingers, and in this game, finally, Ilanga and Callum Hudson-Odoi both started the game. So there was that early link up where, as you've mentioned, Ilanga challenging the Henry space, went up against Aaron Hickey multiple times. I do feel though that Forest, as usual, right, with the plethora of players that they buy, they have pretty good depth. I think we're going to see names like Chris Wood and Divock Origi feature much more, and than we think they should, and it's going to be a little bit uncomfortable because it basically implies that no Forest player will get 90 minutes. I mean, Morgan Gibbs-White didn't start; they went with Dominguez instead. It's very puzzling right now for Forest because I cannot say what competitive advantage Steve Cooper has over the rest of the league right now with this squad. It's very, very bizarre. Yeah. However, Brentford do have competitive advantage here, and they're basically leaning all their attacks to the right side now. They've basically abandoned the left, and it's a case of the right creating for the left. So if Mbeumo pulls out wide, the chief creator is still Matt Jensen. I don't know if we will ever take him seriously in FPL this season, maybe next season. But for now, at least I can safely say that Wissa had multiple decent chances as the number nine. So, if you're ever looking at getting rid of Wissa on the free transfer, you might want to hold that for a little bit more, maybe give it one more home game. Because yeah, the stats say that Wissa did get decent chances, even though it's away against Forest.
That's really interesting. That there are, I mean, in the forwards, you can't really stick with players like Wissa, right? Like there are so many kind of like important players to have, and emerging players. Darwin might even be an option now for at least a couple of games. So the right, you said the right is creating for the left now. Does that include Mbeumo when he's pulling wide and even playing a little bit deeper?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, sometimes Mbeumo even creates for himself. The biggest problem with Brentford right now is not Mbeumo, it's not Wissa, it's not Lewis Potter, it's the cursed player of the league. Want to guess who gets the big chances but is unable to finish? Who is up there?
From Brentford?
Yes.
That's not Wissa?
Not Wissa. I'll give you a hint. He used to play for a different team wearing a blue shirt.
I don't know. Who is it?
Neil Maupay comes on as a sub, as a plan B. Oh, no. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, that's, I think that's our cue to move on to the next. Whenever any conclusion leads you to Neil Maupay, it's time to kind of like abandon the conversation, I think. So if things are falling for Neil Maupay, Brentford's in trouble. So on that note, we will move on to our last fixture of the game week, Fulham versus Chelsea. Net XG, Chelsea 1.37, Fulham 1.39, so quite close. FDR disagrees here with Chelsea 1.9 positive FDR and Fulham a negative 0.3. I didn't watch this one. I haven't seen the highlights or anything. So I'm coming into this one completely blind. So I'm looking forward to hear what you have to say about this one.
Well, I was looking forward to hear what Mariner had to say about this one because Sterling did not start the game. We were talking about his potential as number 9. So somehow, somewhere, Mariner probably sneezes, right?
Breuer should be in a good spot.
Breuer was in a good spot. And he profited primarily off Cole Palmer's positioning on the right side. So this is a little bit more interesting because compared to the free-flowing dinosaur running, you know, Sterling does, the things that Sterling does. Cole Palmer actually has a lot more poise to the way he plays. He's a bit slower, but at the same time, when you play a left-footer on the right side, it does open up multiple angles to create different types of chances instead of just running down the wing and crossing with your right foot. Those diagonal through balls actually suit Mudrik very well because, you know, you imagine like two diagonal runs converging into the middle. So if Cole Palmer's passes primarily aim for Breuer and Mudrik makes the blindside run, then Mudrik gets a lot of chances. It's just such a shame that Mudrik didn't last the half. Right now, Chelsea are definitely in transition. We're not even talking about their left back or their right back. It really just comes down to each player adapting to the challenge ahead of them. I think the biggest issue here is that Chelsea took the lead so early, right, in the first 20 minutes, that they did not have any incentive to push further forward. That's my biggest issue. Like, if I were to read you the stats, right? Okay, Mudrik, Breuer, two big chances in the first 20 minutes, right? After that, it's basically everything less than 0.10 XG all the way until the second half, where Fulham, really fought back. So the focus really is actually on Fulham because I think a lot of people on Wildcard are considering having Bern Leno as their goalkeeper, as their first choice goalkeeper alongside Matt Turner. So we have to talk about Fulham's potential, like defensive potential, especially since we established now that Andres Pereira is playing on the left side of midfield. The irony here is that Fulham actually played better when Andres Pereira came off. Not because of Raul Jimenez, but because of his replacement. Tom Kenny did a much, much better job supplying balls to Raul. So I cannot say right now, right, because, it wasn't Kenny that was his replacement. It was Lukic, Sasha Lukic. Like literally the minute Lukic came on, he basically had this big chance where he bombed into the box. So The irony here is that Fulham, when they want to be more attacking, they play more directly and they play worse. So that bodes well for teams that want to attack them, because that was when Chelsea's players actually had all the big chances. So I think for Chelsea, right, just as a watch list worthy thing, because I'm not going to recommend buying Chelsea players, Cole Palmer on the right side, big tick. Maddison or maybe Enzo Fernandez on the left side, also potentially a big tick. But we just keep the conversation there because we don't know what happens between Breuer and Jackson when Jackson's back from suspension. And we'll just leave it at that. We'll just leave it at that. The biggest promise right now, Enzo Fernandez on left and Cole Palmer on the right side. That's it. Oh, yes. And Vinicius for Fulham. Yes.
Vinicius for Fulham. One thing I'll say about the Chelsea's left side is Mudrick's out, Chilwell's out. Maybe Sterling goes to the left.
Yeah. Well, the substitutions read Breuer off for Sterling, so Sterling played the number 9 and immediately considered a yellow card. But Maddison was the one that played left midfield, so Maddison's next in line.
We'll see. We'll see how that changes. I think with those left wingers out, Maddison's not a left winger, is he? And are you going to play sit? I don't know. Anyway, we'll see what Poch tries to do. But I would imagine that Sterling comes in on the left hand side, and you keep one of Jackson or Breuer at the 9. I'll leave Breuer for a while if I were him. But this is pure speculation. Cool. Well, I think we've done it, my friend.
Yeah, we've done it.
Look at that. 56, heading on 57 minutes now. So we got 3 minutes to get out of here as we get to the slides. Thank you to the people in the chat. Calvin's in the house and Colm's in the house. I think we mentioned most people. Sac Bastios, he treated his wife to the hairdressers so he could watch the show. Keep it up, lads. We will. And you keep up being a good husband there. Now, really quickly, the mini league, join our free mini league. The code is HUP69D, or in another language, HUP69D. Please join us. It's you'll beat all of us because we're doing terribly. I think still haven't checked my rank, might not this season at all. Life is much better without rank. Quick thank you to the haulers, because we do have the couple minutes here, and I haven't done this in a while, and I appreciate you all so much, so I'm happy to do it. David Harrison, Zach, Harborboy, Daddybot, Greenback Golf, and FPL Robbie are our super haulers, and our haulers are Dread FPL, FPL Craig, Podna, Kevin Rose, FPL Saffer, Connor Hunt, Donny FPL, Oscar Arias, FPL Teacher in the house, Blonde, S. Scotters M, Tom Gorsuch, Tavindra Raj, Lindsay O, FPL DJ Boy 88, Akshay, Dom, Claire FPL, Catherine A, William, Harry Not Kane, Neil, Sebastian Koo, Benjamin Lockwood, FPL Rubber Ducky, Neil Zappel, Nick Khan, Big Mike, FPL Discomfort, that's Kieran right there, General Zod, Gwalady Street Preach Something, it's a long name and it's really small, so I can't read it, Jack M, FPL Planner, I think that, is that, yeah, FPL yeah, Planner, Tien. Jamie, it's Tien, right? That's what I thought.
Yes, yeah,
who's actually on the SideNet podcast that came out today. So check that out. Some content from down under there with Tien. Jamie Baker, Brett M, Mark Bond. We have Elron, FPL California, Thingamabob, Ram Frosk, and Mike Burke as we're hitting 59 minutes here. And that is the matchups review show for game week 7. Tomorrow we will be with you with the matchup show with FPL Mariner. Hopefully FPL Nima's well enough to join us. And Lucian, man, I appreciate your hard work. I love your insight. I'm going to use all these notes to write the matchups thread and get things going for tomorrow. So thank you so much for joining us. Thanks again for this review show. Really appreciate you, my friend. I think Lucian has frozen there. I'm still trying to get us out under the hour mark. So I'll just say thanks to the haulers and to everybody. Peace.